On the night of November the 21st, 1974, 21 people were killed and 162 were injured when the IRA planted two bombs in two pubs and left without giving adequate warning. Sadly, those unfortunate people who were injured or died were not the only victims that night.
I come from a very heavy British military family and background. But my older brother, he joined the British Army in 1959 when my father came out of it. My father served 30 years in it. And then when he came out in 59, he came out on the Friday. And my brother joined it on the Monday, joined my father's old regiment, the Scotland Knights, incorporated with so many others. The old 18th Field Regiment, Royal Artillery Regiment. And of course, my brother was in the army from then right up until 1988, I think it was, when he came out.
James McDade was a man Paddy knew well growing up in Belfast, but he had no idea that he had joined the ranks of the IRA after his brother Gerard had been shot in the back by the British Army. He learned of his IRA activities in November 1974 after James was killed in a premature explosion while planting a bomb at a telephone exchange in Coventry.
I never knew James was in the IRA until after he died. I knew him in Birmingham. I grew up with him and his family at home. His older brother was one of my best mates. His brother was shot on the doorstep in Belfast, and that's what forced James McDade to join the IRA. We decided to go home for McDade's funeral. I met up with the others on the night of the bombings at Birmingham New Street, about 20 to 8. And we were on the train at 10 to 8. And we left, and we knew nothing about the bombings. We were playing cards on the train, having a great crack. When we got to the boat, we were getting off. You hear all the crap from the Birmingham police about the big dragnet that was going on that night. An absolute load of rubbish. The security, when we got to the Hessian boat, they come through the old iron tin things, you know, with a door, and you come in the door and you're right on the concrete concourse, and the boats are about 20, 30 feet away from you. They had about six or seven little tables like that used to see in the coffee bars with the wee skinny legs, about 18 inches square. There was a half a dozen or so of them across there, and behind each one there was two cops, one in uniform, one in plain clothes. And I went up to this one, and I'm talking to him, and he asked me where I came from. I told him Birmingham. He said to me, "Do you mind coming into the office?" And I said, "Yeah, where is it?" And he said, "Behind you." And I turned round, it was a port of Cabernet Casino building site. "Yeah." And he turned round and he says to me, "Do you owe the courts any money?" And I busted out laughing. I says, "No, any money I owed the bastards, I've paid them." And he turns round, he started laughing. I said, what are you laughing at?" He says, "Well, if you paid the courts money, you must have some sort of record." And I busted out laughing and I said to him, "Listen, let me tell you something. There's only one thing in Ireland that's green. That's the grass, not the people. I have a criminal record. I lived next door to a police station in Kingstanton. So if you want anything, pick up the phone, plug yourself into the Swansea Criminal Records office. You can have my life story in 2 minutes." And he walked me out of there. He took me through the barrier. And he walked up me to the boat to the gangplank, and we stood talking there for about 5 minutes. And he said to me, "Listen, Paddy," he says, "I've got to go. I think I'm nipped off. I'm still working. All the best." And he shook my hand. And I got on the boat. I'm on the boat having a pint. I'm waiting on the others coming. So I'm thinking they're getting the same treatment as me. Like, you know, they're being questioned and what have you. I've got no worries. And then the next thing I found out afterwards, them four had agreed to go to the police station of their own free will. They agreed, "Yeah, we go down to the police station, not a problem." And as they're getting into the van, Jerry Hunter, the cop's just about to close the door, and Jerry Hunter pushes the door open and he turns around and he says to the cop, "Hey, mister, what about our pal Paddy Joe?" And the cop looks at him, he says, "There's another one." And Hunter goes, "Aye, Paddy Joe, he's probably on the pub having a pint." That's how they caught me. So much for his being involved in IRA and being highly trained in counter-interrogation techniques and trying to flee the country. You know, just stupidity, the things that they came out with.
When the police boarded the boat, they found Paddy drinking Guinness at the bar. He was asked to accompany the officers, and after finishing his pint, Paddy complied. Back in the ferry terminal, Paddy was told that his friends, Hugh Callaghan, Jerry Hunter, Richard McIlkenny, Billy Power and John Walker were being taken to Morecambe Police Station to make statements about their recent movements. Paddy was asked if he would go too, and he replied that he was happy to do so.
And I got out of the car and walked up the steps into the police station of my own free will. And I sat down and Fred Willoughby came in behind me and he said something to the desk sergeant. And he said, "Me, sit down there, Paddy." And I sat beside the door and I'm about, what, 10, 12 feet away from the door. And I sat there until 2:55 on my own. The desk sergeant was the only one in the station in front. And he left the desk 3 times and came out behind the desk and went in through rooms there in the back wherever he went, I don't know. I could have got up and walked out of that police station any time I wanted. And I sat there for an hour and Fred Willoughby came in to me and he says, "Paddy, it's freezing in here, come on in here." And he took me in the back where it was a bit warmer. And he said, "We just to save time, would you have any objection to making a statement?" And I said, "No, not a problem." And him and Sergeant Watson came in and they sat down with me and I made a full detailed statement of my movements 48 hours, 72 hours before the Birmingham pub bombings. And they went away. And they came back at 6:30, just after 6 o'clock, about 6:15 that morning. And they told me that everything that I told them was perfectly 100% true.
Later that morning, officers from West Midlands Serious Crime Squad arrived in Morecambe to interview the suspects.
Big shadow loomed over me and I looked up and this guy's there and I'm looking up at him and he's staring at me and I'm staring at him and suddenly he bent over and he rubbed his hands like that and he went, "Soon, you little Larry's bastard, soon, you little fuck pig, you're mine." And he spat in my face and he walked away. The cop's name's Bennett, Sergeant Bennett then, and him and his sidekick, a fella called John Brand, detective constable. And Bennett says to me, "Stand there against the wall," and I'm standing against the wall. And next thing I knew was he came up behind me and he grabbed my arm and twisted it up my back into my shoulder blade. And I remember screaming out, "What the fuck's the rough stuff for?" And he said to me, "Soon, you little bastard, you're going to find out in a few fucking minutes." Bennett pointed to the door and he says to me, "In there." And as I walked in the door, bang on the back of the neck, and I went flying through the door. And all I remember was somebody shouting, "Don't mark his fucking face, don't mark the bastard's face, anywhere but the face." And that was at 8:55 that morning. And they played football and they got us in that room and they told me straight. They started battering me. And then Bennett picked me up and he put me in the chair. And he said to me, and this is the part that I can't forget, it goes round and fucking round and round in my head every day. He turned round and he says to me, quote, "We know you didn't do the bombings. We don't give a fuck who done the bombings. We've got you. That's good enough for us. It keeps the public off our gaffers' back and our gaffers off ours." And then he walked over to his pocket and he pulled a bit of paper out. And he come back to me and he pulled my head back. And he said, "Me, read that, you little bastard. Read the fucking thing. Look what it says. That's our orders." And their orders were that they were to get confessions and convictions. And they were to use them, to use any means that they had to obtain them. And they were not to worry because they were covered all the way to the top. And he put it back in his pocket and he turned around and he said to me, "We didn't pick you. You've been selected," and he pointed at the ceiling. "You've been selected by members at the highest level of government and that's our orders. Now you can have it the easy way or the hard way." And he picked up the statement form. He said, "The easy way, sign on to the right-hand corner of the caution and the bottom right-hand corner of the page. And the next one." He said, "You can help us to fill this out if you want. It doesn't matter. We'd fill it out ourselves. It doesn't make any difference. That's the easy way." He said, "If you don't want it the easy way, you're going to have it the hard way." And he made a circular motion with his finger. And he went round the fucking walls. "Are you going?" And I went, "I ain't going to sign." And that's as far as I got. The next thing I knew was on my back. And they played football with us. They dragged us up and down the floor. They were standing on my wrists, standing on my ankles, slapping me, punching me. Bennett, he smoked them little cigar shoot things and cigarettes. And he was holding them up to my eyelids and telling me he was going to blind me. They carried on torturing us. They tortured me that morning from 9 o'clock until about 2.
Rather than conduct interviews at Morecambe Police Station, detectives decided to transfer Paddy and his friends to Birmingham, where the bombing atrocities had understandably created huge anti-Irish feeling.
And they put the handcuffs on me, put a coat over my head, took me out, and they put me in the back of a car and handcuffed me to the little roof rack above it. And then they went away. And about 5-10 minutes later, Brian came back, and he was the driver. He sat in the driver's seat. I'm handcuffed behind the front passenger seat. And another cop come. And this is the first time I've seen him. Detective Inspector John Moore, the second in command of the operation. And he looked in and he said to Brand, "Who have you got there?" And he says, "I've got Hill." And he said, "That's good, that's the bastard I'm looking for. Don't you go without me, I'm traveling back with you." And once we got out on the motorway, Bennett pulled a big truncheon out with a big leather thong on it, and he started whipping me across the chest. And then he started ramming the truncheon into my privates. And he was screaming at me, "I'm going to bust your balls, you bastard. You'll make no more out of these fucking hoes when I'm finished with you." And of course, the next thing I knew, Moore turned round in the front seat and he's kneeling on it. And he pulled his gun out and he says, "You know what? I've had enough of you, you little bastard." And he started fiddling. I would swear he loaded the gun. But anyway, he turns round and he says to me, "Open your mouth. I'm going to give you one chance," he says. "If you don't sign a statement, I'm going to pull this trigger and I'm going to blow your fucking brains out." And he told me to open my mouth and I wouldn't open it, and he whacked me on top of the head with the barrel of the gun. And I went and he rammed the gun into my mouth and he's wrapping it round my teeth like this. And he went right and he pulled the hammer back. "What, you're going to sign a statement, blink your eye. One, two, and on the count of three," and he pulled the trigger, and honest to God, Bernard, I can still see that hammer falling even today, 40 years later. And it seemed like an eternity, and all of a sudden you hear the click. And he pulled the gun out of my mouth, and he says, "Fucking hell, I must have got a dud bullet here. I'm lucky I'm not in a firefighter, I'd be dead." And he says, "Anyway," and he's done something, they've gone second time lucky. And again, he whacked me on the head, and the same thing. Blink your eye, one, two, and then the third time he pulled the trigger, and the same thing again. And the third time he done it, Bennett pushed me over into the corner. He said he didn't want no fucking fiend and blood in him. So Moore leaned over and he screwed it into my left eye, the barrel of the gun. And he turned around and he said, "Third time lucky." And the same thing again. And he pulled it again. And after the third time he said, "You've got more lives than a fucking cat. Wait till we get you back to Larpatch." And then they carried on punching me and slapping me all the way down the motorway till we got the Queen's Road Police Station.
The following morning, the torture and abuse of the six men continued. When Paddy was informed that one of his friends had admitted their guilt, he refused to believe the police. But Billy Powers had cracked and signed a confession. The Birmingham Six, as they became known, were charged with murder the following day.
But I knew we were going to get convicted. I remember on the Saturday night, about 6:30 or so, after they stopped battering me, and I heard a noise in the next cell, and I got down to the pipe, and it was Billy Powers. And the cops had been telling me that Billy Powers had made a statement and that we're all in it, and that so-and-so had made a statement and so-and-so's making one, etc. Of course, I knew the score. My co-defender's never been in trouble, only me. And I knew it was the old bullshit as usual. And when I heard Billy's voice, and I remember saying to him through the pipe, "Billy, the cops told me that you made a statement. You signed a statement. Tell me it's not fucking true, Billy, please." And Billy just burst out crying. He says, "Me Paddy Joe, I'm sorry." He said, "I couldn't take any more." And I said to him, "Don't worry, son." I said, "We sorted out when we get for trial." But I knew then that we were doomed.
In August 1975, the Birmingham Six were sentenced to life imprisonment. All of the men denied being involved in the atrocity and began a campaign in the hope of clearing their names. It took them 17 years to secure their freedom at the Court of Appeal. Unfortunately, the story doesn't end there. Following his release from prison, Paddy Hill suffered post-traumatic distress disorder and continues to suffer to this day.
The Birmingham police know who did the Birmingham pub bombings. And I say that for two reasons. In 1974, a member of the Birmingham IRA, went grass, and they rounded up, I can't remember how many of them in Birmingham, but 14, 16 of them, whatever it was. And they were in custody from March or April 74. I've no doubt that that informer also gave them the names of other people, which they hadn't arrested at that time. After Morris Buck, the assistant chief constable, after he made his statement to the world media on Sunday the 24th of November 1974, our names come up on the television. There was an informer then, and he went and got in touch with his handlers, and he told them, you've got the wrong people. And he sat down, he made a detailed statement, and he gave them the names of the two people who made the bombs, where they made them, and the three people who came along later and picked them up and planted them. Jimmy Gavin and Mick Murray. Jimmy Gavin was one of the bomb makers. Mick Murray was one of the planters. And the three others are still alive. The people who done the Birmingham pub bombings are walking about the streets of Dublin as free men and have been ever since the Birmingham pub bombings. And that's perfectly true. They were. And they still are, those that are alive. When I came out, little did I realise that I was going to jump out of the frying pan into the fire. As I say, I never realised what the outside world was like when we came out. And I was told by psychiatrists after I came out that I'd been diagnosed as suffering at level 4, which is the highest post-traumatic stress disorder, even worse than soldiers. Some of the most experienced forensic psychiatrists in the country, Professor Gordon Turnbull, etc., who treated Terry Waite and all the rest of them, and the soldiers coming back from the Gulf War and Iraq and what have you, diagnosed as us the worst that he's ever come across. And it was, what, 92, when I started breaking down. One minute you'd be dead happy, the next minute you'd be sitting there crying your eyes out like a child. And I was wishing to God I was back in jail. In a lot of ways. And sadly, Jerry Conlon isn't here. If Jerry was here, he would tell you the same thing. In a lot of ways, we were a lot happier in fucking prison than we were outside. Well, they took us out of the prison, but they didn't take the prison and all the torture and brutality and everything else that we suffered out of us, and it still goes around and round and round every fucking day of the week.
But is your anger self-contained, or do you feel like you should do something?
At times, I feel like exploding. I feel like running amok. But I have to contain myself, because if I did, I'm never taking out on some poor innocent bastard who doesn't deserve it. And that's what stopped me, that's what frightens me, because I can go over the top very easy and I would lose control. And that's the last thing I want. I don't want to make any more innocent victims, you know. But if we could get the Birmingham Serious Crime Squad in one room, believe me, I wouldn't go in and shoot them. I would go in and I would fucking butcher them, and I would do it quite happily. And I would get enjoyment out of it. Believe me, for what they'd done to us, there was no need to do it. But they just weren't interested in the truth. And the Birmingham police, even today, and the judiciary and the government still won't tell us the truth. They won't tell us nothing. They hide it all away just because it's too embarrassing for them, and it would do them too much damage.
Paddy Hill was arrested and jailed for 17 years simply because he was en route to a friend's funeral. We are all judged by the people we associate with. In the same court just 3 years later, Harry McKenney was accused of 6 gruesome murders by career criminal and fantasist John Childs. McKenney's wife Eileen was also deemed a suspect, but a suspect in what has never been explained.
He done one jump up, right, in a lorry, and he got nicked, and he done 18 months. That's how he met in prison. If he hadn't done that, this wouldn't have happened, meeting Childs.
There's a way to make an entrance.
My destiny.
It was now a conspiracy of witches.
Download Veely today.
Following Charles and McKenney's release, Charles was arrested for a series of robberies. In an effort to broker a deal, he claimed McKenney was responsible for 6 murders, and so the police issued a warrant for his arrest.
The radio come on and said we were looking for Britain's most notorious hitman. And then they said Big H McKenney, Harry McKenney. All the newspaper, all reporters come round. They wanted all the inside information, anything else they could find out. They even said that he killed my nan's sister's boy, son.
Oh,
he committed
I forgot
suicide.
That.
My nan's sister, yeah. Her sister Gracie had a son. And
she adopted him.
Adopted his son. And he committed suicide. And they actually tried to say that he killed him. It was wild speculation going on to the point where, you know, the things that were said in the papers about what he's supposed to have done, it was like they painted a house of horrors.
Harry McKenney and John Charles eventually stood trial for 6 murders. It was the prosecution's case that the pair carried out the killings in return for cash. The victims, who included a 10-year-old boy who just happened to be with his father when he was targeted, were beaten, stabbed, hacked with an axe and shot. Their bodies were cut up, put through a mincer machine and burnt on a fire in Charles' home.
When it came out in the papers and on the news and everything about this notorious killer, you know, and the House of Horror thing, you had the police come in. Because basically we were like marked, yeah, because we had the second name, McKenney. And then you've got the people in the immediate area that think you're a family of a murderer. You know, like, because, you know, it wasn't accused of like, oh, he caught his wife with someone and killed him. No, it wasn't like that. He was supposed to be a hitman, an actual hitman. He's supposed to have killed these people in cold blood for money. You know, the things they said that he stabbed them, he shot them, he cut them up, he minced them in a mincer. He's supposed to have burnt them in a grate and dismembered them. You know, it was terrible, really, really graphic, nasty stuff they were putting in the papers. So, you know, we were vilified. There was a whole load of vigilantes who come and put the front of the house in. And we were, luckily enough, my nan went to the neighbour's house because she knew that they were coming round, but they see us go there. So instead, they put the neighbours in thinking we live there. They were coming, it was like something out of a film, I swear to you. I kid you not, it was like something out of a film. I've never seen so many weapons coming through a front door in my life. I distinctly remember it. They put all the front door in, they went over the garden to try and get in from the back. This didn't just happen to our house, it happened to my dad's house as well. It happened to anyone who was in the family because they believed that we're the family of murderers.
If he'd have been a gangland contract killer, I don't think he would have been subjected to that. Wait, it was the fact that there was a 10-year-old boy murdered as well.
That's exactly it. Because a child, obviously, you know, it's understandable. Anyone's going to go mad, especially with what they're supposed to have done. But, you know, the newspapers didn't even know where my nan lived until the police told them. The actual police in Scotland Yard told the papers where to find us.
Not only were innocent members of the McKenney family suffering harassment from the public, the police and the media, attempts were made to frame them for fabricated crimes.
CID turned up at the house and said they were returning my dad's property, and they delivered a sawn-off shotgun. It was loaded. And it's only because there were so many witnesses at the time, people all around, the milkman was there, everyone was there, the postman was there, that many people around to see that these CID had actually given it. We've actually got documents where they have made an official apology to my dad for delivering that to him. But if they hadn't seen it, if we didn't have the witnesses, that would have been, again, another trial. They tried endlessly. I mean, the amount of times our house was raided. I knew them on a first-name basis. You know, you walk down the street and they just deliberately pull up beside you. And they had a very sarcastic sense of humour. So, you know, it was a case of they'll walk up your gate and come knock at your door. And it's not like now. Now there's more policing of police. Back then, you're talking early 80s, the police were like a law unto themselves. If they had a problem with you, they'll just come. It's not like they didn't need to go through all the red tape to get in your house like they did then. The amount of time she's been down a cell waiting, you know, and then they'd let her go. She made complaints, they ripped them up. They actually ripped them up in front of her. And they actually said to her, you should write a book. And they was laughing. It was like them and us. And if you think about it, we didn't actually do anything. So it was very isolating. And this was all because of the Big H trial. It is the catalyst that made everything, it made all that happen.
The evidence against McKenny was a mixture of suggestion, probability and guesswork. Rather bizarrely, in an effort to prove McKenny had disposed of his alleged victims in a household fireplace, the police butchered and burnt a fully grown pig. The trial at times could only be described as a farce.
My granddad was accused of killing four people, yeah? George Brett and his son, and two others. And Charles said that to rid themselves of the body, what they did is they cut up all these people and they put them through the mincing machine, and anything else they burnt in this little tiny grate, and it actually got rid of the bodies, all of them, every single one of them, this way, yeah? So the scientists went in and they got a pig, and they're, you know, obviously of human size, weight-wise, and they cut it up, dismembered it, and they burnt it in the grate, and they come to the conclusion that it was possible to actually burn a human body in a tiny grate, and bones, everything in all its entirety, they could do that. And apparently this is supposed to have happened for four people. However, the heat was overpowering and the smell, the stench, was going through, it was everywhere. They couldn't escape the smell. It was so bad they had to leave the property. But yet in court, they thought that meant it was possible. Even though it was masonette and it was a block and there was loads of people who lived around who could have smelt this smell but didn't, you know. They're supposed to have killed these people and burnt them there, but yet no one knew. Oh, this terrible smell that the scientists couldn't even stand, but no one smelt it in the street. So, but they still thought that would be, it could be used in evidence to say that he did that.
Despite the dubious evidence and the credibility of his accuser, Harry McKenny was convicted of four murders and sentenced to life imprisonment.
He was given life imprisonment, plus later on he was considered one of Britain's most dangerous men. So he was given the white letter. So that means he was an all of life term.
Whole life term.
Yeah, he would never get out.
They said if he pleaded guilty, he can get out on parole. He would not.
He was convicted on the testimony of a fantasist. Charles would literally, he'd magic this stuff out of thin air. And there was no factual evidence. There was no bodies ever found. There was no forensics evidence. There was no DNA evidence. There was nothing. It was literally a case of he was sentenced on the basis of a liar. She went to go and see him in court because she couldn't actually believe that he was actually getting sentenced for this. And he was chained down. He was chained down to the chair. He couldn't move.
Whilst his wife and family suffered extreme adversity on one side of the prison wall, Harry McKenny was protesting his innocence from the other. Not wanting to be left out of the debacle he had created, John Charles wrote two letters to Michael Mansfield, who was McKenny's barrister.
After the trial was completed, Charles wrote his first letter to Mansfield, and it said that he deliberately done this to get back at the establishment. That's what he said. He said, I did this to make a mockery of the establishment and cost the taxpayer millions for the trial.
They spent millions of pounds on this case, he said, but he said, he's innocent, he said.
Yeah.
Bring me up, yeah.
And then he sent a second one.
Yeah.
That was for his next appeal, saying that he was actually coerced and blackmailed by the police doing that. There was also a criminologist who investigated as well, and they felt that with Charles, when he's telling the story, it's like he's a fantasist and he gets pleasure out of trying to think up more gore, more shocking, more something, you know, that really makes people go, oh, my God. That was his power. He felt power and control in that way. And that's what they felt about him, that he was a fantasist.
I think there's something definitely wrong with him.
To confuse matters further, it was muted by a police officer that one of the murder victims might actually still be alive.
Terence Eve apparently was found living alive 2 years after my granddad was sentenced. It was covered up by certain police in Scotland Yard. It was covered up. That's what they said, that he was in police protection. And this come to light after he'd been sentenced, after he'd already gone down. This is about 2 years after. And they refused, the current police at the time refused to investigate.
23 years after being convicted on the word of a psychopathic liar, Harry McKenny was cleared at the Court of Appeal and walked free. Hand in hand, the judiciary, the police and the media had turned a willful blind eye as Charles convinced the jury that an innocent man was in fact an evil contract serial killer.
Even now, when he's been released, there's an air of, you know, how can I put it? There's an air of, oh, well, he has been acquitted. But they're not apologising. They're not saying, oh, we got it wrong. They're not saying, we're sorry for what you've suffered. It's more like, do you know how they're portraying it? They're portraying it like it was a technicality he got out. They're not actually saying, oh, he's innocent. They're not standing up and saying, we're sorry, we got it wrong, you're innocent. And we're sorry for all the damage this has done to you. They're not saying any of that. It's more like he just slipped out the back door. That is what it feels like that they've done to him.
Stephen French needs little introduction. In books and on television, his time as a young man who robbed drug dealers in Liverpool is well documented. Known as the Devil, he earned his nickname because of the fear he instilled in those he taxed and tortured.
The name, the Devil, follows me everywhere. The book was called The Devil. What you've got to remember is that's not a name that I give to myself. That's a name that my enemies bestowed on me. That's a name that people that come into contact with me that I absolutely destroyed and terrorized when I was a young man, and that was my nature. I was a young man in the 80s. This country was a different place in the 80s. And I was involved in what's now called jacking. Back in my day, it was called taxing. Tying drug dealers up and taking the money off them and doing what you need to do. All my life, Ben, from a kid at school, the establishment has tried to pin labels on me. Social workers, when I was a kid, sending me to see psychologists and psychiatrists and trying to say that I'm some kind of nut. I've been labelled a police informer, a homosexual, a hypocrite and a fraud. And I'm here to say that you can put any labels on me what you want. I ain't going away. I'm continuing doing what I'm doing because I'm not no police informer. I'm not no homosexual. I am an anti-gun campaigner.
French became an anti-gun campaigner after his best friend Andrew John was shot dead. His nephew Anthony Deacon was shot in the head. And his son Stephen was shot twice within 12 months. After experiencing the horror of gun crime firsthand, French re-evaluated his life and walked away from crime. Unfortunately, his former associates in the underworld believed that he had sold out and began a campaign of abuse and intimidation. When matters escalated and attempts were made on his life, French had to make a decision: run, comply, or die.
There's a thing called an Osman warning. An Osman warning is a warning that's given by the police, that they have intelligence that you, your family, or people around you's lives are in danger, and they have a duty of care to come and warn you about that. In my situation, they pay lip service towards their duty of care towards me, yeah? And they also have the responsibility and the protocols of their office to keep confidential any intelligence that they gather. But they took it upon themselves to share false intelligence about me with the criminal fraternity, which had the effect of acting as a catalyst, an accelerant on an already burning fire. On, I think it was Thursday, the 28th or the 29th of February 2013, I was arrested on the Wednesday. I'd received the Osman warning, and I was staying in a Hilton hotel in Liverpool because the cameras are there, everything's there. It's good security to stay in a hotel if you're under pressure from people. The police were monitoring my phones. They knew the messages I was receiving. They knew the death threats that I was receiving over the phone, and they knew where I was getting them from. Yeah, these people were threatening to kill my wife, threatening to rape my daughter. Now, at that time I was 53, I'm 55 now, yeah, right? And I'm a physical guy, and I can still handle myself. This guy who was having the problems with it, young enough to be my son, big guy, heavy guy, refuse to fight. Refuse that. I'll have a punch up with anybody. Win, lose or draw. As long as I represent myself, that's all I care about. This guy's telling me he's going to shoot me, he's going to do this and he's going to do that. The pressure from the police, pressure in the community, trying to do what I'm doing, I snapped. I broke under the pressure. 2 days earlier, I decided I'm going to buy myself a machete and I'm going to go, if I wanted to get a, you know me, Bernard. If I wanted to get a real firearm, I could get a real firearm. If I had a real firearm, I'd have shot him. I just wanted to pistol whip this guy. There's a phrase called OG. OG's original gangster. I don't consider myself a gangster, but I know what an original gangster would do. And I pistol whipped this guy into submission for what he did to me. All my problems ended on that day, but I knew I was going to prison for it. I got 4 years, and I did 2 years in prison. And you know what? Fucking weird. I knew the cost of my actions. I knew the consequences of my actions. The consequences were I was gonna lose my liberty. The cost was I'd lose it for 2 years. Yeah, that's a price I gladly paid. Now, what people fail to realize is at the time of my arrest, I was under investigation by Merseyside Police, Manchester Police, West Yorkshire Police, Durham Police, because in my legitimate business activities, I was up and down the country. The problem they had been is they could find no evidence of criminal activity. They targeted me as a criminal. They wanted me in prison. The average Joe on the streets won't believe how corrupt the police can be. In order to land a man in the dock and get what they want, they have no idea of what lengths senior officers will go to. I kind of fell on my own sword, but it didn't kill me, Ben. It wounded me, but I didn't die.
French may not have died, but the criminal fraternity was still intent on killing him for campaigning against guns and crime on the streets they controlled. As soon as French had been arrested, prisoners were sharpening their knives in preparation for his arrival.
So from behind the doors, the shouts went up, "Frenchy, you grass. Frenchy, you this. Frenchy, you that." I was nighttime. Next morning, I'm on the fours, B Wing, Walton, Liverpool. It's got to be the 1st of March, something like that. I come out onto the landing, 250 men. Any pussy in this place wants to have it with me, I'm here now. You could have heard a pin drop. Such was the strength of my character. Such was the iron of my words. Yeah, right, not one challenge yet. Not one challenge yet. Those who think I make stories up, those who think that I talk through me backside, the 250 men were there. Apparently, I'm a very arrogant man. Apparently, I'm a very conceited man. Now, I've learned to let go of my arrogance. I'm no longer conceited, but I'm still self-assured. I still know who I am. I still know what I can and can't do. Yeah, now I'm restricted by license conditions, but prison holds no fear for me. Yeah, right? I don't want to go back to prison. Yeah, I don't want to do no more prison. So I will avoid trouble at all costs. I took the laws of the land into my own hands. Yeah, right? And I went to prison for 2 years. I explained to my wife, real talk, you know, real talk. What do you want to do? Do you want to come and visit me in prison? Or do you want to come and put flowers on my grave? You have a choice. What would you pick? Box or cell? I chose the cell.
French emerged unscathed from prison in February 2015. He was told that if he remained in Liverpool, his safety could not be guaranteed. Typically, French has said that he will use his experience of prison to assist young offenders, and he will continue to campaign against guns. As for leaving Liverpool, he will do so if and when it suits him.
What I have every intention in doing is picking up the threads of my life and carrying on doing the work that I was doing already. You're right, because here's the situation. When I was working as an anti-gun campaigner and doing good stuff in the colleges, in the schools, in the universities, yeah, my Kazuna Increased the Peace Trust was growing. Memberships in 40 countries throughout the world. We were doing okay. And I came to the attention of, let's call it the establishment in Liverpool. And you know what? This uppity nigger had to be tucked down, yeah? Now, you might think, why is Stephen using that phrase? What they forget, this is what top brass police forget. When they have their dinners at the Adelphi or at the Hilton, and they're having the policeman's balls, they forget that the Silver Service staff are just normal people. Yeah, and I was heard being discussed at top table about how I had to be brought into line. Now, I was of the mind that nobody can tell me where I'm gonna live or where I'm gonna be. This is my town and I'll stay where I want. People telling me that I can't be here and they're trying to run me out. I will leave when I'm ready to leave. Each and every one of them that have come against me, and you know who you are, have come unstuck. This guy always, always finishes on top. And that's what they hate, Ben. That's what they hate.
Miscarriages of justice. A soldier butchered on the streets of London. Poverty. Global terror. And immigration. They have all been topics of conversation and much debate this decade. People talk as if our world is teetering on the edge of an abyss. But however dark or troubled our lives may seem, these days will become the good old days for our children. Ever spinning, ever evolving, the world and our lives are constantly changing.